Welcome to a special edition of Space Game Junkie Podcast. I'm Jim. We get to talk to David Westman, who was the designer on X-Wing versus TIE Fighter, X-Wing Alliance, and also was a mission designer on X-Wing and TIE Fighter. So we've really been wanting to talk to David for a long, long time, and finally got to. He is working for Impeller Studios, and they are in production of Starfighter Incorporated right now. He's working with Jack Mamace, who was on MechWarrior 2, MechWarrior 2 Mercenaries, worked on Heavy Gear 2, and then some other interesting folks that are working over there, Corey Seifert and Mark Wilhelm. So really tight crew of people that are going to work on this game, and from what I've seen of the game, it looks awesome. They got a Kickstarter going, and that's going to be wrapping up in the next 30-some hours. So I had a chance to talk to David, and took it. So here you go.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, doing good. So you've been doing a lot of this lately, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. It's like part of the whole Kickstarter campaign is social media, getting the word out. And so that was always part of the plan that we'd do that. But I think we drastically underestimated the time commitment.
Yeah.
You see, there's definitely a resurgence in interest. And over the last few years, there's at least a couple of dozen projects have been announced. And
yeah. What happened? Okay. Because we're both kind of like finger on the pulse of that leg of the industry. But I can't identify, like, what was the turning point? Was it Star Citizen that actually showed everybody, like, oh my God, there's money here? And then they all came out of the woodwork, or what?
I don't think necessarily that. And the reason why, let me back up to X-Wing and Wing Commander. Wing Commander started out as a Star Wars project. Chris pitched it to LucasArts, and at the time, he didn't have a big track record in the industry, and they're like, who are you? We have people that do flight combat for us. And so they turned him down, and he went off on his own. Wing Commander came out before X-Wing, and so there was this perception that Wing Commander broke new ground and, you know, started the genre off. It's like, well, no, they got out sooner, but we were well in development before they were done making their game.
Oh, really? So that's informative, because I thought that, you know, that Wing Commander came on the scene. I would say the greatest success of Wing Commander was selling sound cards.
It was yes. Like,
oh my gosh, Adlib and Sound Blaster were made by that game.
Yeah.
And
that well, and yeah, it's the technical arms race in the hardware needed to run the latest games. Back in the day, you know, hardcore players were a hugely important factor in the game industry. And to this day, to be honest, I haven't heard any numbers that disagree on this. While the hardcore segment is the minority, they're like 5% or less of the audience. They buy like half the games.
Right. Well, it's the 80-20 rule. Somebody mentioned that to me.
They're the opinion leaders. So the more casual gamers, they know somebody who's a hardcore gamer. That's the person they ask, you know, what, you know, if I like racing games, what racing game should I get? Oh, you should get this one.
Right.
I forgot what that was related to.
Just talking about the resurgence and stuff. But
oh, the resurgence, yeah.
But were you guys actually, you were in development before Wing Commander came out. See, that was the thing, was like, well, Wing Commander came out, and then LucasArts had made Secret Weapons of the Luftwaffe, which I understand you were involved in. But it's like, so they were doing that, and then it's natural, like, well, Wing Commander successful, hey, let's pitch an X-Wing game, because now we can actually get that made, because look at Wing Commander, right? So, but to find out that it was actually already happening is like a new thing to me.
That, and it's often the case. I mean, sometimes it does happen that way, and this is, I think, very true in Hollywood from what I've read, that's why they're so secretive about what projects are in development, because, you know, like the year that Deep Impact and Armageddon came out.
Right, or like three volcano movies in the same summer.
Yeah, or the Plague that's going to wipe out humanity all of those ideas. But a lot of times it really is just simply a matter of it's kind of in the air. There's multiple people thinking of it. And so it appears that maybe one is inspiring the others, but I think a lot of times it was all independent, and whoever gets out first successfully is going to get credit.
Right.
One of the big frustrations of my career was a project I worked in. It was the last thing I worked on at Totally Games. It was going to be a launch title for the Xbox. And it was a flight combat game, but it was creature-based in a fantasy setting. And we had the creature that you rode around on looked like a seahorse with wings.
Oh, weird. I assume this did not come out, because I don't remember anything like
that. No, it was a tragedy.
Yeah, because you started talking about like a creature flight combat thing, and I was just like, we're due for a remake of Dragon Strike, so
yeah. Oh,
do.
God, I would love to return to that concept. But well, let me. So it actually started out. Larry had the idea. He'd been watching some anime, and he wanted to do an alternate world. It was basically an ocean planet with a lot of spire-like island chains, and the technology was going to be, you know, like early mid 20th century. So essentially a World War II air combat, but a complete fantasy setting. And so we'd just gotten started on that when Crimson Skies was announced. And we're like, oh, now they're just going to, you know, we're going to be accused of just copying them. And so we went back to the drawing board. We had a big brainstorming session. And it was my job to try to reconcile as much of the ideas that were produced into something cohesive. And that ended up being this creature-based game. And the big innovation that we were going to introduce was melee combat in a flight combat game. So we knew we could handle dogfighting. That was our safety net. But let's see if we can do something nobody's done before. Sort of like 3D Joust.
Yeah. Awesome.
The problem being, and my inspiration for the flight model was I had hummingbird feeders in my backyard, and they're really aggressive with each other. And it reminded me of jousting. And so I thought, and that's a really cool flight model too, because they're very precise and rapid maneuvers, and yeah, they can hover. And
well, so, speaking of joust, I can't believe nobody has made a 3D game where you're on an ostrich with a lance. I mean,
well, I think here's the problem that maybe they just didn't think of the solution that we came up with, was that if your closing speed between both entities is on the order of 100 or 200 miles an hour, aiming your joust the last, you know, just before impact, that's going to be pretty iffy. And my solution for it was just go into slow-mo, just in the last moment before contact.
Oh, okay, and that's kind of the solution you guys were talking about with the Starfighter, Starfighter Incorporated, right? Is kind of like the pilots are so tweaked up that it...
Well, you know, similar. I mean, conceptually similar, but in implementation quite different. In implementation, what we were doing, it was called Archipelago, was what the world now knows as bullet time.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, it was one of those things where I, like, if Archipelago hadn't gone pear-shaped, it would, because Microsoft was going to be the publisher. When they signed on, all we had to show anybody, we talked to a bunch of publishers, and they all were really excited. It was basically a 3-page document with some concept art.
Well, now that you named the game, I remember the name. It was like I remember like some magazine article or something that somebody wrote that was talking about Archipelago, unless that's a different one.
There's a different Archipelago that came out.
Oh, okay.
It was sort of a sequel to Sentinel, I think, or it was one of those Rainbird.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Late 80s ST Amiga company.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, Microsoft. We went with Microsoft, and they told us, we think this is going to be a system seller, you know, on the level of Halo. So I'm pretty stoked, because my reputation at Totally Games was he's the hardcore flight sim guy, the war gamer, not a fan of fantasy. And how did he come up with this incredibly cool hardcore fantasy game? So I'm very proud of what I've done. I had been a sort of a one-man skunk works for about a year while the rest of the studio was working on Star Trek Bridge Commander. And So
you didn't have a hand in Bridge Commander at all?
No, it was such a, the ironies of history. It was
is that like a relief, like you didn't have a hand in Bridge Commander? Because the Bridge Commander is like two different games, and there's a great game and a not good game that got...
I had a completely different concept, which they decided not to go forward with. And but yeah, I'm more of a Star Trek fan than a Star Wars fan, so I would have loved to do something in the Star Trek universe.
Shh, we won't tell anybody that.
Yeah, Star Wars is awesome, but it's fantasy. It's set in space, but it's fantasy. Star Trek at least tries to be a little bit more science, and sometimes actually gets it right.
Yeah.
I thought it would be a really cool project. I pitched an idea that I thought was really cool, and maybe someday I'll get the opportunity. The rest of the team went ahead with a different idea, which I don't think was a bad idea. The reviews were pretty good. I mean, it's got like an 80% on Metacritic or Game Rankings. But the Archipelago project, it was such a thrill. It was like, oh, this is going to be a launch title. They think it's going to be a system seller. And then I get to watch it get destroyed in front of my eyes as the team tries to redesign it by committee. And I'm like, guys, we don't have time for this. We need to move forward. And that became an unhappy time in my life. And I ended up leaving Totally Games to go to Stormfront, where they had started working on a Bloodwake game.
Yeah, that was the Xbox launch title with the boats, right?
Yeah. And so
that had really cool water effects. The thing that I remember about that game.
That was such a fun project. To this day, that is one of my top projects. It was a great team. Hands down, the best tool set that I've ever worked with. And it was a type of game they had never made before. So they were looking for a lead designer, and I popped up and was like, oh, this is perfect. This is exactly the guy we need. And it was, just such a great time. The lead programmer, Ralph Nocell, he had created the game engine during his holiday break. He's one of those really smart guys. And the two lead artists, Tim Dean and Matt Small, the four of us, as Matt came up with the idea for this Easter egg mode, it's called Blood Ball. And it's basically like giant bathtub shaped arena with a rectangular goal area at either end and a 10 meter soccer ball in the middle and two heavily armed gunboats on either side. And we had so much fun with that. Every day at lunch and at 6 o'clock, we'd have a little tournament with most of the team hanging out and just hooting and hollering. And initially, Microsoft wasn't even going to let us put it in the game because it wasn't in the original plan. And, you know, they've got everything carefully budgeted out, you know, how many QA resources for how long and so forth. And we were like heartbroken. It's like, wait a minute, this is really, really fun. And they go, all right, you can put it in as an Easter egg.
Which is unfortunate, because had it been like because the game, did it have multiplayer or was it a single player title? Okay. I didn't know if it was just local split screen or what.
Yeah. It's just split screen. There weren't a lot of games supporting internet play at the time.
Mm.
And that was an aspect that we actually did start working on a sequel that was going to expand on the whole feature set. It was going to have multi-crewed boats, co-op missions where, you know, each player has their own boat, actual currents and different levels for the water. Lot of cool stuff. And we were about 4 or 5 months into it. And finally, we get the letter of intent from Microsoft saying, yes, we're going to go forward. It's a Platinum Series hit, the first game. So it's a no-brainer. Let's make a sequel.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't realize it did that well. Because it was, you know, a launch title thing, right? But I just wasn't aware of sales figures or whatever. Yeah. So that's good. It was as successful as it was. See, that's a thing. A game, when I look at that, I'm like, okay, that wave physics thing that was going on, it just seems like at 3 o'clock in the morning, somebody invented this wave physics thing and was like, my God, look at that. Now we got to put a game on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, is that kind of how it went down? Or?
Well, I don't know exactly what Ralph's inspiration was, but internally, when they saw what he had done, their thought was, let's do Twisted Metal on water. And that was the pitch that they were presenting to various publishers. And they just, nobody was willing to commit on that. And Microsoft, coincidentally, they had the success with Crimson Skies. They had started developing an internal IP that was basically a Crimson Skies set on water. So they're looking for a studio with a boat combat engine. And when they see what Stormfront has, they're going, hey, could your engine support a story-driven mission-based game? And yeah, of course it could. And so, yeah, there was just a serendipitous occurrence there that led to a really, really good game that sadly didn't get as much of attention, I think, as it deserved. And I don't know the details. All I know is that, you know, when the sequel got canceled, it seemed like there was some ill will between the parties. And the reason that I suspect that was the case was because even though it was a Platinum Series hit, it disappeared from store shelves. They stopped making it.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, speaking of stop making, nobody has made, to the best of my knowledge, any kind of like a speedboat combat type game.
I know.
And gosh,
it's bizarre. There's a Russian studio that did a PT boat game, and it's more of a simulator style game.
Yeah, I own that, and that's what I was thinking too while you were talking.
Knights of the Sea, yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's like, you know, it's kind of like if you took Mad Max and put him in a PT boat. Right, it's that sort of, and honestly, that's the niche to put it in, right? Is like post apocalyptic boat warfare with zombies. I don't know how you do, but
I'll tell you where we kind of wanted to go. And I actually did. It was a student project. We decided to do sort of the spiritual successor to Bloodwake, and for a variety of reasons, it didn't happen. But internally, one of our elevator catchphrase pitches was, it's like a kung fu movie set on water. And so taking that to its logical extreme, we decided, because none of us really liked the name Bloodwake that was imposed on us, our preferred name for the game was Mad Monkey Gunboats on the Seas of Fury 3. And... And, you know, wanted to go much more over the top with the action. Mm-hmm. And so when I had some students, you know, pitch to me, hey, we'd like to make a game like Bloodwake. And so I started telling them these stories, and they got really excited. And I said, okay, so here's what I want to see you guys do. I introduced them to the work of Big Daddy Roth, Ed Roth, the hot rod designer. He's like the guy that created custom t-shirts.
Yeah.
And he'd do these just crazy, exaggerated vehicles with these monstrous characters. And during the Vietnam War, he did a lot of versions of that style art.
Well, I remember like
for the military.
Was it Monogram or somebody? They made models, right?
Yes.
Of his stuff, yeah. Because my cousin had some. And I remember as a wee lad, I was not allowed to touch those. And. Yeah.
Well, so Mad Monkey Gunboats on the Seas of Fury 3 was going to be made by students, and it was going to have that Ed Big Daddy Roth art style. But as so many student projects go,
yeah. Well, you know, there is a movie. It's called Order of the Black Eagle, and it has a orangutan. I think it's an orangutan or a baboon. No, it's a baboon. He has a pet baboon that drives a tank. Other than that, it's Eagle's Nest, but and it has a baboon driving a tank. So,
it's a well-known fact that if you put monkeys in it, it will be more successful.
Monkeys and zombies. What about zombie monkeys? Nobody's done that. That's a
untapped
Call of Duty mode right there, so monkey zombies.
Normally, I have a rule for my students is they don't even bring me a zombie idea.
Yeah.
I might have to bend the rules that for monkey zombies. I didn't.
Yeah, monkey zombies with laser eyes or something. Yeah, it's I don't know, the zombie thing. It's safe, right? Because you can shoot zombies, you can shoot robots, and nobody cares, right? So it avoids like a whole plethora of issues and whatnot. You know, talking about like boat games, right? And then also the Star Wars, Star Trek, space Wing Commander thing. The one game that I think is starving for a remake is Subwar 2050. Because
you know what?
It's underwater X-Wing.
It's so funny that you mention that, because one of the struggles that we had with our game is that if you do the deep analysis, the hard science rationale, it gets harder and harder to justify one-man fighters in space.
Right. Yeah, I've been down that road with people on the show before. It's like, explain to me why. What does this thing do? Like, why wouldn't I just throw missiles or something?
So we think we've got some plausible rationale for that. But along the way to that decision, I said, hey, did you guys ever play 2050? Because we could do a very realistic sub-warfare game, and our justification for having the high speeds that we want is this phenomenon called supercavitation.
Oh yeah,
which is something that the Russians have implemented for a torpedo that does like 500 miles an hour underwater. So, you know, extrapolate forward a few generations of research and development, and now we've got basically fighter aircraft underwater.
Yep.
So that's still an idea I want to pursue.
So in dealing with the Star Wars canon back then, you kind of had it easy, right? Because, you had experience on Secret Weapons of the Luftwaffe, which was an awesome game for the time. But it's like coming from that, and then Lucas also had this vision of like, you know, the trench run is like the movie The Dam Busters, and the, you know, it's Mustangs and Messerschmitts basically in space is kind of the whole Star Wars feel of it, right? Because he wanted the rolling dogfights and all the maneuvers and stuff. So the ships basically fly like airplanes, and then there's no relativistic speed, and there's not even any kind of vector problems. That, you know, because it's like this ship has a top speed of 300 miles an hour, and
yeah.
Right, and even in a product today like Elite, it's still the thing, right? Is like, well, my sidewinder goes 300 when I've got the afterburners on, and then it slows down for some reason, and that. But it makes the game manageable, because back when Braben did Frontier, and we were talking about jousting, right? That's what Frontier was like when you'd get into combat, because it's like you head at the guy, you take a couple of shots, and then you have to turn 180 degrees and decelerate, and then accelerate the other direction. So you're just doing a series of head-on passes. It's like playing chicken with spaceships, and that was not fun. So
yeah,
you know, with Star Wars, at least you had the excuse baked in. It was like, well, this is what it was on the screen, and we replicated that in the game, and you know, just accept it, right? That's what everybody wanted. Where do you go from there? Where like you want to have like the Independence War, they brought a little bit of Newtonian physics and momentum to the game and stuff. But it still has like a flight assisted whatever. Where are you guys going with Starfighter? Is it like you pulse the engines and drift most of the time, or top speeds, or what?
There's no speed limits, and managing your supply of propellant is a concern, so you don't want to be on the accelerator the whole time. You also don't want to be going so fast that you end up leaving the engagement and having to spend too much time getting back.
Mm-hmm.
So the our one bit of serious hand waving that we're doing, we alluded to it earlier, is that the pilots are cybernetically, pharmaceutically, however, they're enhanced, and their brains are going 100 times faster than a normal human brain. And so coping with the simulation speed, you know, your speedometer in the game is going to tell you that you're doing 20,000 miles an hour. Because your brain, as the fictional pilot, has been sped up to 100 times normal, that will appear to you as several hundred miles an hour. So we're back down into the comfortable range for humans to dogfight in.
Right.
And it's a rational, plausible answer.
So, but speaking of comfort, so you have a human body inside the ship, right? That's a problem because G-forces, right? Like a pilot can take 6-8 Gs right now and they black out. So how do you deal with that?
I've been doing my research there, and that is not strictly true. Okay. There's a big difference between instantaneous G-forces and sustained.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about sustained G-forces, then yeah, you can't do that for very long. But for momentary G-forces, you can spike pretty high.
Oh, really? Because looking at and this is another thing about just spaceships in games, right? Because we know if you accelerate half of the trip, right, and then you turn tail and decelerate the other half of the trip, and then you arrive at 0 miles an hour at the other end, right? You get to Mars. But doing that trip, it's still going to take months to get there, right? So is that kind of what's going on, like drop fighters at some point?
Well, yeah, so the way we're handling the actual gameplay is that it's a mission. It's a scenario. It's conceived as an event that takes place over 15 to 45 minutes, maybe an hour at the most. So there, you know, between propellant supply, heat buildup, or just that window of opportunity. Like one of the mission ideas that we're working on has a damaged carrier attempting to leave the Saturnian system. And it needs to do a gravitational slingshot around Enceladus. And the interception force, the only one that's available to do anything about it, has this narrow window of opportunity to get in there and damage the ship so that it can't complete that maneuver and escape into the asteroid belt.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's pretty neat. I guess with the starfighter thing, right, because... Well, and you brought up an interesting point about heat being a limitation, because in space you don't have a medium to radiate heat, and if you have these big engines, they're going to heat the ship as much as anything, right? And and with an airplane, you have all that air that runs over the engine and dissipates the heat. In space, how do you radiate that? Right. So, and especially if you have an engine that has to produce the amount of thrust that you would need, like I've seen this Ad Astra games made this thing called Vector Thrust. Have you played that?
Sadly, I must admit, I have not. I own the game, and I keep trying to get people to play it with me.
You and I are in the same position because I pull that game out. I'm like, this game's awesome, and then they look at it and they're like, no.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like they because it's like, okay, Starfleet Command or Starfleet Battles, whatever, we can handle that. But then they start looking at this thing and it's like, nope, no way.
Which is such a shame because like it says on the box, they've done the complex math for you and they've got play aids that just walk you through the steps. I was at a board game convention. And it's called Birds of Prey. It's a modern jet combat game, but it uses the same system. Mm. And so they're demoing it. And I'm like, oh, great. I can finally have somebody explain how the game works to me. And these two guys, it was so great because they're so excited and really happy to explain their game to somebody. And they're going, oh, so it's really simple. So you do this, and you take this factor here, and you put it in this table here. And you roll the die, and you take that result, and you apply it over here. And it's like, right, and I'm looking at the guy. He's like, What do you do for a living outside of this? And it's like, I'm an engineer, and you? And it's like, I'm a physicist. Yeah, okay, it's simple to you guys.
Right. Yeah, because, and you know, honestly, it's thanks to you and your friends that I have like a 3D spatial imagination, right? Like if I'm in a game, and specifically like X-Wing TIE Fighter, right? Because you have instead of taking the Wing Commander radar approach where you just have one radar, stuff in the center is in front of you, stuff that's on the rim is behind you. You actually have discrete front and rear projections of radar, which is great, right? So with the, I would say, thousands of hours of TIE Fighter, I'm so ashamed to say, that it's kind of like whenever something disappears off the screen, I can just it just happens, like, instinctively. Like, my mind projects, like, where was he headed? What was his angle? I know where he's at. So if I turn the opposite direction, and I guess, like, a regular jet fighter pilot gets that, too, right?
Yeah, but you have the
constraint of, well, you're in an atmosphere. There's only limited whatever he could do.
Yeah, the possibility space isn't quite so large.
but it's the thing of, like, so having played these games and flight sims and all that for so long, then I just have this 3D spatial aware imagination, right? And then I talk to other people that don't play these games and they can't get their head around it. It's just like and to me it's so natural, right?
And that's exactly one of the reasons why these games stopped being made. Because it turns out that it's a relatively small segment of the population that can wrap their head around it. And when I was doing research for all of the flight combat games that I've done, I have this ridiculously large library. One of my best books it's called The Ace Factor by Michael Spick. And it's based on a tremendous amount of research about what makes an ace pilot. And it basically comes down to situational awareness. And, you know, historically, it'd be one pilot in 20 became an ace. The other 19 were basically targets that occasionally got lucky.
Yeah, targets for the ace.
Yeah. And so, you know, I thought about that a lot. And in the design of the UI and, you know, how the missions are designed and how we train players to play the game, it's to try to get them up to speed to achieve what you achieved, which is that spatial awareness, that sense of where things are around you, not just horizontally but vertically as well.
Right. Well, that brings a thing in here too, though, is back then we had the limitation of you have a flat 2D screen with a 3D projection and maybe a 70-degree angle of view out of it. Today we have like the head tracker stuff, you know, track IR and the I forget what the other one is. Brian's got one that's pretty cool. It doesn't even use a sensor there. It's just like a gyroscope that sits on your head. And then they even have them that use the gyro sensors in a cell phone, which looks a little goofy, like to duct tape a cell phone to your head, but people do it. But now, you know, it's like, well, Oculus Rift proved, hey, we can actually make a consumer 3D visor that doesn't suck. And now I see there's like five other companies that are rushing them out that are various levels of better or worse. So that's going to be a thing. I would say within the next 12 to 24 months that's going to be a thing that, and we talked about, like, the hardcore gamers are the ones that drive adoption, and those are going to be the people that I would say 80% of will have them.
Yeah, so it's going to be just like audio cards and 3D accelerator cards. Once people have experienced it, because this happened to us, you know, theoretically we're like, oh yeah, VR, of course, that's really cool. We want to do that at GDC last year, 2014. Corey was the first one. He went to do the Eve Valkyrie demo, and immediately texted us all. It's like, stop whatever you're doing. Go do this demo right now. And so as soon as all of us had done the demo, we walked out of it. It's like, yeah, okay, we have to do this. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah. So how do you deal with, okay, I'm going to make a game that is satisfying to the person wearing the 3D helmet, but also equally accessible to the guy who's not? And we stick them both in a dogfight together, and the guy with the 3D helmet doesn't have, you know, godlike powers compared to the other guy.
That's a really good question, and I don't think I can give you a good answer yet because we haven't been able to test that to see what happens.
Send me an Oculus, I'll test it for you. I'll do that free.
But we're working with Oculus, and we actually have some dev kits, and we're still working out some code issues with our engine to make it work. But I mean, intuitively, it makes sense that, you know, the guy with the VR rig is going to have an advantage. But that actually, it makes complete sense in a realistic perspective. Take a look at modern combat aircraft. If you took an F-16 up against a Eurofighter Typhoon, the Eurofighter Typhoon has basically an augmented reality headset. They've got a helmet-mounted display system. The pilot is able to literally look through his aircraft, like he has X-ray vision.
Oh, that is cool. I haven't seen that yet, so that's news to me. I mean, I knew they were working on this stuff, but...
And you've got these high off-boresight missile systems so that you don't even have to aim your plane at the enemy. You could do a closing pass, right, the jousting thing, full speed ahead right at the enemy, launch your missiles as you pass him. Your missiles turn around and get him. You just keep going.
Wow. So we've come a long way from the F-22 sims of the 90s where we thought, oh, this glass cockpit, man, that's the ultimate.
That's another example of the sort of struggles that we have in extrapolating what's this future technology going to look like.
Yeah, well, when I was in the Army, I was a crew chief on Apaches, and it was the A model, so it wasn't the fancy radar systems that they have. So it was a little bit more analog, you know, but still a lot of digital, but more analog than it is now. The damn thing almost flies itself now. But the deal, very primitive, right, because we're talking like 1988. Mm-hmm. VR system here. So you have that monocle that goes over
your eye. The first generation VR.
Yeah. So you have a monocle over your eye, and wherever you look, it projects the HUD out in front of you, and the gun also tracks where you're looking. And, mm-hmm. you know, so from the gunner's seat, I unfortunately never got to fly in live fire, but I got to play with it a lot on the ground. And it's pretty disorienting. Like, you know, you'd be tracking a bird or something, and you have one eye doing something completely different than the other one. If you've ever seen that really crappy Nicolas Cage movie.
Yeah.
So true story, I'm in the movie. I'm right. One of the extras. They shot that in our hangar. And
nice.
Those are our birds. The intro of the movie when they have the line of helicopters flying, and mine was the third one back from the front.
It was
the one that I worked on. So
check that out.
Yeah, it was the best line in that movie, because that really was the Fort Hood simulator that they had there, that with that whole Nick Cage with the "I am the greatest." I am. Oh God, it's just so much cringe, man. It was, and we went. They took the whole battalion after, you know, the movie came out, right? And it was like, yay, we got our own Top Gun. Let's all go to the theater, right? And we like rented out the Cinemaplex and just crammed the whole damn battalion in there. And it was just like a collective groan that came up from a couple hundred people.
I could imagine.
It was like when they called the Fulton Finn rockets like missiles. And it's like, oh,
yeah,
God.
I mean, that stuff drives me crazy. And it's not like they don't have the experts available to correct things. It's just they don't care. They really don't care.
They're like, nobody will notice.
Yeah. On the Star Wars stuff, I was the guy that had to recreate the Battle of Endor. And I'm using – this is before, you know, DVDs were really popular. We had a Laserdisc player. So I'm using the Laserdisc collection. And I'm just concentrating on the battle sequences, and I'm going frame by frame by frame by frame over and over and over again to try to make sure that I've got everything positioned where it is in the movie. And I quickly realized that George did not really care about continuity in that particular realm, because it's completely nonsensical. There's things blow up. The shot came from over there, but there isn't anything over there. Huh. And that thing just fired a big blast at nothing. And what's this? There's a negative frame. There's a TIE interceptor passes across the screen. The Millennium Falcon goes the other way. And then for one moment, space is white and the stars are black. And I'm like, what the fuck? You left that in?
Yeah.
But at the time, I'm sure that the decision-making process was, well, it's going to be in the theater. They're not going to be able to pause it on that, and they'll just interpret it as a flash and assume that an explosion happened and move on.
Yeah, but now you have guys like J.J. Abrams that know that people are going to take the trailer and pause every frame. So
yes.
Like with the Star Trek trailer, they hid a URL in the trailer in one frame, right? Like, go here, here's the mystery, whatever. So the whole X-Wing thing, like how did it come about at LucasArts? Like you were a tester on Secret Weapons of the Luftwaffe, right? Was that
right.
Like your first gig there?
Well, actually, my first project that I was assigned to was Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis.
Oh, cool.
And then I worked on Monkey Island 2.
So did you that was like in Tim Schafer's presence or what?
Well, the test crew was deliberately kept separate from the developers.
Uh-huh.
And even more so on Fate of Atlantis, Hal Barwood, who is the project director on that game, had, I guess, an unpleasant experience on his previous project, and he thought that part of the problem was that the testing department people got, I guess, a little too passionate about it. I don't know what the problem was, but he felt that there needed to be some separation between the testers and the developers. And I mean, in professional development, it is almost inherently an adversarial relationship because testers are breaking your game and telling you what you did wrong. And nobody wants to hear that, right? So the funny thing is I had my previous career, I was doing concert audio engineering, and I was touring the U.S. and Europe as a sound man, mostly for thrash metal bands. And my best friend...
Okay, that explains your haircut at the time. Because,
yeah.
Because back then you actually had the Wotan weave. You had some death metal hair back in the day.
Yeah, I did. My buddy Dave Maxwell, he and I met in sixth grade and became best friends. And we were the smartest kids in class because back then they actually posted grades publicly so we could prove it. And
as opposed to the everybody gets ice cream days that we're in now, right?
Yeah. And he had gotten a job at LucasArts as a tester. And I had done my last tour with a band called Violence, who was also the band I did my first tour with. And the last tour was kind of a disaster. And so I took a job selling pro audio gear. And I'm talking to Dave, and he's talking about the games he's working on. I'm like, you know, the next time they have any openings, let me know. Because he and I are gamers from way back when we were kids. And I credit this for both of us becoming game designers. We accidentally discovered war games. I got a game called Panzer Blitz when I was 11 for Christmas. And it was the most complicated thing either one of us had ever seen. And it took us about 3 months just to figure out how to play it. But then we were seriously hooked. And the game, it's World War II, tactical armored warfare, East Front. And it's basically a game design kit. Because it has a number of scenarios and it has a number of pieces. What attracted my 11-year-old brain was, oh, it's got 300-something pieces. And I thought it was 300-something little tanks. And it turned out to be little chits of cardboard with silhouettes and numbers and stuff. And so after we had played through a number of the scenarios and the map was divided into three panels that could be laid out in different ways to recreate different battlefields, and we went, well, let's play a scenario that's got more of the cool late war tanks. And so we're just making up our own stuff. It's like, you have just taken the first step towards being a game designer. So anyway, fast forward.
See, it all starts with mods. Modders.
Yep. Absolutely.
So was that a Gary Grigsby joint or no?
No, this was paper. Avalon Hill.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. And because, yeah, this was 71, 72. There were no personal computers.
Okay. I'm sorry. I had about a decade of difference in the thing.
No, my first programming class was on a PDP, a Deck System PDP 11, punch card input and teletype output. And I still tried to make games.
Did you ever drop your stack of cards?
I think I did do that once.
Everybody did it once.
Yeah.
There is no twice.
So back to the story. Dave's got a job as a tester at LucasArts, and he lets me know the next time that they're hiring. And I come in, and he's giving me some advice on how to get through the interview. And so I'm talking it up because I know he's told me they're working on secret weapons of the Luftwaffe, and that's what I would really love to work on. And so I'm talking about all my military history knowledge, and particularly World War II and the aircraft. And about 15 minutes into it, they're like, yeah, you're good. We're going to hire you. But we've scheduled an hour, so we have to keep talking. Yeah. And then they let me know, but but we need you to work on the Fate of Atlantis. And I, but I'm not really a graphic adventure guy.
Yeah.
And well, too bad. That's what we need you to do. And I'm like, all right, okay, fair enough. I got to pay my dues.
So story about you in my life. So my first IT job that I ever got was working help desk at a little mom and pop ISP. So I go in to interview with the guy, and the guy's like, well, you know, tell me computer stuff. What have you done, right? You know, do you know about online stuff and whatever? And of course, this is like 96, right? So this is barely – the internet barely exists. So I'm talking to this guy, and he's like, well, do you game at all? And I was like, yeah. And I've been playing, you know, like a lot of TIE Fighter and stuff. And then somebody made this mission editor. So I started cranking out some campaigns, and I made like one 20 mission campaign. And I even forget what the name of it was, but I told him about it. And he's like, oh, I played that. It's like, I totally downloaded that. And he's like, yeah, that was pretty awesome. Cause I did some weird stuff in it. And it was actually like a story that I'd written. It wasn't just random missions, you know, look cool things. Right. And based on the fact that I had written an X-Wing campaign, or a TIE Fighter campaign, rather, that the guy had played, he hired me.
Very nice.
That's why I'm So I'm like a storage engineer today, but I owe it all to X-Wing mods.
What? So, that's how Bill Morrison got his job. He had been in New Jersey, he's a big fan. Had joined some community. They were, you know, had their own hacked mission editor, and they were making missions. He got a job at LucasArts as a product support guy, answering phones to help people with their problems the games. And when we were advertising for a mission designer position, he was the guy that you know, was like, okay, this guy's, he's already trained. He's already building missions. So yeah, okay, hire him.
So is that the deal where, like, in the back of the manual, it used to be like, hey, if you're stuck in this game, call 1-800, I suck, and, you know, somebody help. So he was, oh no.
Yeah.
There goes my phone.
That was his job. Well, and get this, it was during X-Wing development. I get a call out of the blue, and it's this young guy who's asking for hints on Fate of Atlantis. And I'm like, what? He's like, how did you get my number? And there's a helpline for this. I mean, that was like over a year ago. I really can't help you. I don't remember how to solve that puzzle. And it was like, well, my parents won't let me call that helpline. So he had gone through the credits of the game and then gone, you know, to the yellow page or the white pages and just, you know, maybe I can find somebody's phone number.
Wow. That's pretty awesome. Do you remember the Invisiclues?
Yes.
Yeah. God, dude, where you get a yellow highlighter and you had to... Awesome. Yeah, that's the good old days. See, the kids today, they just don't understand.
So testing secret weapons of the Luftwaffe. At that time, Americans who owned PCs typically had a hard drive and didn't have a huge capacity. Like, you know, 20 megabytes was considered huge. But in Europe, particularly in the UK, which they sold a lot of games there, hardly anybody had hard drives.
Oh, so it had to all run off the floppy?
Well, multiple floppies.
Oh, yeah.
If it would, and it shipped with, I think it was 8 5.25-inch disks or 5 3.5-inch disks. So we had to test it as if you were playing off the 5.25-inch disks, which meant every time you went to the map, swap disk. Oh, you want to go back to flying? Swap disk.
Wow. That's harsh.
people would put up with it because the game was so good.
Yeah, there really wasn't anything like that before. Like the flight sim stuff. What did we have? There was like F-19 and that kind of thing.
Yeah, right? The MicroProse did a bunch of good stuff. There was the Chuck Yeager one that was really good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me, starting at LucasArts, you know, I get the job and I am just ecstatic. I'm working at LucasArts and I can go have lunch at the ranch, and you know, there's all kinds of coolness. But, you know, like 2 months into it, I was like, gee, it seems to be a pretty high turnover rate here. What's that all about? And then the other thing that I realized was, Larry Holland isn't an employee of LucasArts. He's an independent contractor. Oh, I want to work for him.
Oh, that's how you ended up over at Totally, huh?
Yeah, and like I said, I was working on the graphic adventures, and Dave Maxwell's on the Swaddle test team, and I couldn't get on it. I was just super frustrated, and the game had been – it was well past the original deadline, and Larry was known for feature creep because he's an amazing guy. He'd come up with these really cool ideas, and he'd implement them really quickly and make the game better, and he would just keep doing that. And LucasArts was pretty okay with that mostly. It's like, you know what? It's going to be a better game. Let him keep going until he's ready, and we'll ship it. He was done. On Secret Weapons of Lifwaff, he was done. Dave Maxwell, because the policy at LucasArts was that we will not ship a game that has a repeatable crash bug. If you find a repeatable crash bug, then we're going to fix that. Dave made it his mission in life to find a repeatable crash bug every day, and he did. he's that good. He just the code here is probably susceptible. I'm going to go hammer on that.
And that's the thing. When you have a QA guy that actually knows how the code is working under the hood, as opposed to just like, oh, I'm really good at video games, give me a QA job. But if you have somebody that's actually a coder and they can understand, like, oh, well, this is probably loading this array, so if I do this, then I'll probably like actually overload this thing or like overrun a buffer or whatever. And then, yeah.
Well, so he's single-handedly keeping the game from shipping. And, you know, they're all like, well, what do we do about this? And it's like, oh, well, you know what? Dave's accrued a fair amount of vacation time, and it's use it or lose it time, Mr. Maxwell. You need to take some vacation time.
so they put him on a plane to the Caribbean so he can ship the game.
Well, I don't know about the Caribbean, but he was basically told, yeah, you need to take some vacation. That was my opportunity. I was the only person available who could step in and play the game at his level. And so that gave me the opportunity to meet Larry and make an impression on him. And then I was able to get to work on all the expansion discs and cement that good impression and convince him to hire me directly.
Oh, that's awesome. And so the thing with Swaddle was, like previous flight combat games, they did wireframe planes because nobody could do like textured polygons or anything back then. But Swaddle, I don't know, was it the first game that did it where it was actually like rotoscoped? So you had different sprites and you'd just swap one sprite for what angle. And then Chris Roberts took that and did it in Wing Commander with great success.
Well, and a story that Larry told me, which has gotten sort of confirmed by people that would know, was that Chris came up to him at a trade show and boasted that he had reverse engineered Battlehawks 42. And that's the Wing Commander engine.
Oh, wow.
I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, because Chris said the thing that got him in the door at EA was, darn it, I can't think of the name of it now. It was in my mind. But it was that RPG game that he did with the knight guy.
That was the first game that he did, yeah.
Yeah, and it had what was notable about that is instead of like a health bar, there was a candle on the side of the screen that burnt down, and that was kind of neat. But yeah, I remember playing that like on my Commodore back in the day, and and then suddenly Wing Commander, and it's like, what? That's not the same guy. So yeah, a little bit of ramp up in skill in short order there. But yeah, so gosh, it's the Battlehawks engine, huh?
Yeah, there was still snippets of code from Battlehawks in X-Wing Alliance.
So, oh wow.
Yeah, I remember one of the programmers just kind of shaking his head. He's like, you know, we have this little bit of code has been in there since the beginning.
Wow. So you were a mission designer on X-Wing, right?
Yeah.
And did you do Mission 4?
Yep.
Oh.
lesson learned. It's a novice designer mistake, right? You get really good at the game and you keep tuning it for your skill level, and you don't realize what you're doing.
Well, it wasn't that that was a Dave Maxwell thing too, right? Because he was super hardcore.
Yeah,
he's an A-wing guy, and I hate A-wings. Yeah. Like A-wings are the worst damn thing ever when you're in a TIE fighter. And you know, it's like, give me a TIE fighter with shields. It's called an A-wing, bastards. But
yeah, no, Dave and I, we were this rivalry going back to sixth grade. You know, it's like we'd do custom missions in Swaddle and see who could shoot down more planes. And we're like, oh, God, we got to get multiplayer so we can prove who's better. And then, unfortunately, he left the company right after TIE Fighter, so we never got to do that.
Mm. Well, we have an opportunity, though, because on Thursday nights we play X-Wing versus TIE Fighter. So if both of you guys show up, we can officiate. That'll be the real contest. Like, it'll – you know, we can make it official that you won in a tie-in, right? So, but you know, so much of that game actually, XVT is amazing because it allows you to co-op through the campaign, and how you guys built that so that you can have a single player experience, or you can get eight humans in there and still have a mission that is a challenge but doable. That I don't understand how that works. Like, because the AI is not, you would think the AI is not as good as a human. But then again, like I was telling you, we're stuck on mission 12, right? Single player, I can beat it. And I think it's because I have absolute control over all the wingmen, and they do exactly what I tell them.
Well, it's been a while, so my memory may be faulty, but I do believe that there was a check on how many players are in this mission, and that the difficulty might have been adjusted in response to that. So
maybe that's why it gets so bad whenever we got a lot of us.
Because you do still have three difficulty settings. That was the lesson learned from mission number four. And if you're playing solitaire, at the lowest difficulty setting, you should be able to complete the campaigns. But if you choose the higher difficulty settings, you almost have to have other players with you. And if you choose the highest difficulty setting with eight players, it's the hardest it's going to be.
Oh, wow. So there's like three difficulty levels, and then within those, there's multiples based on how many people.
I think that's true.
Okay. Close enough, right? But how did you guys actually edit missions? I mean, I was telling you the story about how I did it, right? Because those people like hacked together their own editor. It was pretty awesome. Did you guys have an editor, or were you like notepad just banging out numbers?
No, it was an editor. Swaddle had a very basic editor, and so the editor for X-Wing came out of that. And it was a DOS tool.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was first created, Larry, and this is how I became a mission designer, he hired me to be his lead internal tester. And then I convinced him that he should also hire Dave Maxwell. So Maxwell left LucasArts and came and joined us. And he just said, hey, anybody that wants to take a chance, or give it a try, go ahead, go make missions, here's the tool. And there was about a half a dozen people who decided to do that, and Dave Maxwell and I proved to be the most prolific and the most proficient at it, and so that's how we evolved into becoming the official mission designers for the games.
Oh, cool. So it was like they did, like Larry had a general script, like this is the story arc, and then let you guys go to town?
We didn't even have a story at the start. It was just, we're doing Star Wars, X-Wings and shit, blowing stuff up. And so this is an interesting contrast between Dave Maxwell and I in terms of the style and how we approach things. David would he'd get inspired. He'd have an idea of what would a cool situation to be in. And then he'd start implementing that and then, iterating on it. My approach was much more academic, and I'd do a lot of reading of World War II carrier operations. And so I would get my inspiration from historical situations, and I'd try to recreate those. And so, everybody had their different approach, and we're building this library of missions. And then, you know, at some point everybody realizes, well, but we do have to have a story. It should sort of parallel the movie. That would make sense. So then we started trying to fit the missions we had into a logical sequence that would fit the story. And of course, the first movie, if you take all of the battle scenes out of the movie, you don't have a whole lot of footage. So
yeah, there's like a couple minutes actually of video. Yeah.
So again, the historical operations during World War II and so on provided a good basis for inspiration of, okay, well, there's this battle in the movie and there's this encounter and there's that. What would happen in between and what would be the implications of that? And so then we kind of spun out from there and, okay, well, we actually already have the mission that would be the thing that would happen before that one. So that makes sense. So we're laying them all out and we're starting to build our story idea. And then that at that point we realize, okay, well, so now that we have a story, there's some plot points that would be cool that we don't have missions for. So now we have missions that are being designed specifically to support the story. But it started out with, here's the gameplay and let's make some sense out of it with the story. TIE Fighter was totally different. We actually thought long and hard about our story outline before we started building missions.
Yeah, because the awesomest thing is getting to fly as Darth Vader's wingman, right? Yeah. That's pretty cool. But the whole arc of, you know, like the Admiral defecting and the TIE advanced production and stuff, the missile boat deal is very controversial in our
group.
I kind of like it.
It's fun, but it's sort of a game breaker.
Well, it sort of is, but then again, in the context that it's in, you ain't doing those missions without it. So, but definitely you can't have that in multiplayer because I can just I can stand back at the edge of the map and just spam missiles all day. It's a cool thing. Did it sink in that, oh my God, we're creating Star Wars canon? That Lucas actually picked this up and adopted it, and because at that point, like the weight of responsibility would have crushed me. I'd have just been like, oh no, what do I do?
Well, so I mean, I do like to read, and so I made it my responsibility. And this actually began when I was still the tester. I wanted to make sure that we got the details right. So I just immersed myself in the Star Wars lore and, you know, every comic book, novel, RPG source book. If it had something to do that was relevant to our game, I tried to pick it up and absorb it. And I don't think that they were strictly enforcing canon then.
Yeah. Because there's like people crying a river about Admiral Thrawn today. So,
yeah, so. And so there's things in the games that today are not considered strictly canon. Oh, they totally blew it on that. So, yeah, at the time, nobody told us we were blowing it. We were given approval to do exactly what we did. And, you know, as the franchise sort of reignited and they started taking things more serious, because at first we had very little oversight. They gave us a lot of trust, a lot of respect. You know, Larry had been a consistent performer producing really good games for them, and X-Wing, it was no different. We respected the license. We did our best. It's a good game. George liked it. TIE Fighter, you know, the Star Wars license is getting big again. There are more products coming out, and so they're starting to pay a little bit more attention to what we're doing. There was two places where I had to change something because of feedback from LucasArts. One was during that Civil War in one of the early campaigns.
Yeah, the Sepan Civil War thing.
Yeah, I used the war pogrom word. I'm sorry, I used the word pogrom to describe what was happening in some aspect, and I was told I had to remove that word because people of Jewish descent might take offense. I was, what? It's not worth fighting. Okay. but the one that did upset me was I wrote the lines that Darth Vader would speak when you're flying as his wingman. And what I originally wrote, and I wish I had it somewhere in my files.
Yeah, I heard they said it was a little too sinister. It was like, we don't want Darth Vader to be that evil.
Yeah, it's too dark, Dave. It's too dark. Tone it down. I'm like, but ultimate personification of evil. I thought I did a really good job of channeling that.
Yeah, but that's before we knew that he was just this sweet little kid that pod raced. And oh god. Yeah,
okay.
So here's the thing, right? Like the time traveler dilemma. All right. If I give you a time machine, do you go back to the 30s and stop Hitler, or do you just go back to the 80s and stop Lucas from making Jar Jar Binks?
I think I'm going to have to go with Hitler.
Okay. But it's close. I mean, you had to think about it. So, so see, when those movies came out, it was just like, you know, because it's like, X-Wing, TIE Fighter, XVT, X-Wing Alliance, and then the dry spell, right? Like, this just – nobody's making this anymore. And then it's like, oh, my God, new Star Wars movies. We're going to get more of that stuff. And what we got was – well, Podracer was actually good. That's the only –
yeah.
And Super Bombad Racing, no.
And no. Dark Forces and Jedi Knight were pretty good too.
Yeah, those were cool. But as far as the space stuff – you know, we got Star Wars Starfighter, which was the Naboo Starfighter. The one that I made Brian...
I had a good time playing that game. Well, let me tell you something about that, because that's an Episode One title, right?
Uh-huh.
Before we embarked on X-Wing Alliance, we asked Lucas, okay, Episode One's coming. Do you want us to do a game for Episode One? And they lied to us, and they said, well, we don't really think there's anything in Episode One to do a Starfighter game on, because they'd already decided to do it internally.
Oh. Yeah, that was their weird experiment there, right, where they used to have contractors, and then they tried to take it internal, and then they ended up folding their internal thing.
Yeah.
So kind of a failed experiment. But
well, and the other weird thing was, and let me back up again for some more context. During TIE Fighter, we played a lot of RTS games in the studio, and Peter Lincroft and I were talking one day about the map mode in TIE Fighter, and you know, we could create a RTS mode for TIE Fighter. And our eyes light up, right? And we go rushing off to Larry. Larry, hey, we just got a great idea. Let's add a RTS mode to TIE Fighter.
Yeah, oh my God. Like, you know, you control it on the map, and then whenever the forces clash, jump in the ship.
And Larry just kind of laughs. He's like, yeah, we don't have time for that. And so, you know, after TIE Fighter, the third game was going to be the Millennium Falcon game.
Yeah, you'd mentioned – that was the first that I've ever heard of that, because I mentioned to you, I was like, what the world needs is Privateer set in Star Wars. And then you're well
– We had a very ambitious design, and we spent about four or five months fleshing it out, and then realized that there was no way that we could pull it off. That at the time, the team was still pretty small. And we were going to add multi-crewed ships because Millennium Falcon and interiors and have an FPS mode so you run around inside ships. And all of that meant that, okay, we need a much bigger team and more time than they're giving us because we had basically signed a contract.
But was it the FPS mode that kind of put the nail in the coffin, because that's like a whole separate game?
Yeah.
So it doubles your scope.
Yeah. And so at that point, it was like, okay, well, we've used up 4 or 5 months of our time. We still need to deliver something. And, okay, what are we going to do? The single most requested feature is multiplayer, so let's go multiplayer. And everybody agreed that that was a good idea. And I made the case, so this is my responsibility. I had seen what we were spending on art in the previous games, and particularly what we spent on cinematics was ridiculous. It's like a huge percentage of the art budget went into a few minutes of cutscene. And I thought, you know what, I would really rather that we spent that money on in-game assets that you encounter while you're playing. And so I argued against devoting a lot of effort to the story, and I pointed out that, well, look, look what happens here in the office. When we play Command and Conquer or Doom or Descent, we have these intense matches, and then we meet in the hallway and we talk about what just happened. And so basically we're telling our own stories. So that's what we're going to do with X-Wing versus TIE Fighter. We're going to give the players the toolkit to tell their own stories. So they'll be happy with that, right?
Yeah. Now, had you baked the mission editor in?
Yeah.
Then that would have been a whole nother game.
That was a whole other issue, though, with publishers at that time, Lucas being one of those publishers of the opinion that we don't want to give content creation tools to our fans. That creates problems. So
you can't sell expansion packs then, right?
You can, you still can. But yeah, that was one of the concerns. So XVT went out with very little story, and it also, and I hate the word, rehashed missions from earlier games, but it was because those were really cool missions and they were single player before. Now they're multiplayer and they're being rebuilt from the ground up. They're not just ported over and, you know, flick a switch and now you can have seven more people.
Right. So somebody might protest, but it's really kind of a false protest. But
yeah.
But then again, I mean, okay, yeah, that's a little familiarity, right? So,
but, you know, review after review, gameplay is awesome. This is the best multiplayer experience ever. But where's our fucking story? And you know, all the previous games we did had multiple expansions. So we always planned on doing an expansion, and the content would be based on what was successful with the original release. We'll do more of that.
Mm.
What wasn't appreciated or what they didn't like, we'll fix that. And so Balance of Power addressed those issues. Okay, here's two story-driven campaigns. 8-player co-op, 15-mission-long campaign for both sides. And to this day, I think one of my proudest achievements. We did a great job with that.
Yeah, it's amazing, really.
And for 1997.
Yeah, definitely. Like, the only thing holding that game back was the internet, because 56K modem cannot handle it. You know, but now that we're in the land of cable modems, so the one thing that bit us, right, is we were playing it even before Good Old Games re-released it. By the way, did anybody – what happens with that? Like, Good Old Games puts TIE Fighter out. Do you get a check?
I don't get shit.
knew that was
the answer. Let me rewind just a little bit. When they first released X-Wing and TIE Fighter, I emailed them directly, and I said, hey, I worked on those games. Do you think I could have a copy? And they were like, oh, absolutely, sure, here you go. So I did get that.
Oh, well, there you go. Compensation.
But yeah, with our Kickstarter, PC game piracy has always been rampant. And so, over 1 million people bought X-Wing, over 1 million people bought TIE Fighter and so on. But at least 9 million more people pirated it. And so it was like, okay, so if everybody who pirated one of my games would just give us a dollar, we'd be funded way up there on the, almost to our top tier. So,
yeah. Well, with talking about story and X-Wing, and then you make the transition to TIE Fighter. So the thing that's fascinating to me, TIE Fighter just changed my entire opinion of the Empire in the Star Wars fiction, because, they were like, these are the bad guys. These are space Nazis. There's no redeeming anything about them, right? And then when you get to walk a mile in their shoes, it's kind of like, yeah, they got their own things going on. The story was very well crafted, that it has left a, almost 20-year-long impression on me about, hey, the Empire, they're people too, right? But how do you make that jump narratively in a game where you say, okay, we're going to make a game where you play the bad guy and you're going to like it?
Well, so exactly that, what you said, the space Nazis. So, well, if you grew up in Germany in the 30s, joining the Nazi party, joining the Waffen-SS, all the propaganda is telling you that you are a hero and a patriot and you are fighting against Bolshevism and anarchy and you're fighting the good fight. So that's how we presented it, is, if you live in that world and that's the propaganda that you've been subjected to, it all seems like this is a noble calling and I'm proud to be a part of this. And then what we did with the different elements of the story and the characters that, you know, it's revealed over time that, well, there's a rot at the top, and, you know, you've been misled and lied to. And part of that was my own feeling about military service, that I grew up wanting to be an astronaut. And at that time, the only path into the astronaut corps was through the military. And so I was aiming myself in that direction. I was going to go to Annapolis, and it just by chance, I transferred high schools from California to New Mexico, where in California at the time, they had gotten rid of the high school level junior ROTC, but they still had it in New Mexico. And because I transferred in the middle of the semester, I couldn't just jump into it. I got the opportunity to meet some of the guys that were in it. And they're all good guys. Most of them are there because their parents pressured them into it. But the student commander, who was sort of an odd duck, he drops his wallet one day in class, and one of my friends picks it up. And before we handed it back to him, we looked inside, and he's got a picture of Hitler in his wallet.
Well, very nice.
A light bulb moment for me is like, oh yeah, I've always had a little bit of a problem with arbitrary authority, and I can just imagine how well that's going to go over in the military. And just like, I have a commanding officer who is a dickhead, and Westman, you're on point. Go clear that minefield.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've all my life, I've had this sort of morbid fascination with war and military technology and so on. But, you know, deep down inside, I would say a pretty progressive, pacifistic kind of guy. And so it's this sort of internal dilemma. And so one of the things I tried to do very subtly with the story was just sort of plant that question in people's minds that, you know, taking orders and serving an organization that deals in death, you might want to think a little bit deeper about that.
Yeah, TIE Fighter was pretty darn cool in the storyline department. Like, you know, like I've said, that it took the bad guys and it actually made them into people. And I think that all the stuff that came out of Lucas afterwards that dealt with the Empire in a more favorable, understandable way is perhaps a product of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, because they have a book. It's far too expensive, but it's the Imperial Field Guide or something that it's called. It's like a $100 book, and it's not going to happen. I'll wait till I see it cheap. But it actually goes into, like, here's the organization of the Imperial Navy and, you know, our tactics and how we fight and everything. And it's like,
you just said Imperial Navy. George never, ever uttered those words.
No.
they were in an RPG source book, and so that's what we used in our games. Because, well, it was approved, so I guess that's what it's called.
So, yeah, it's I don't know. I mean, there's so much to do in that universe, and I feel like it got limited by the canon. You know, whether I mean, you can't approve just any old thing, right? But there's so much exploration. I would like, and that's a thing too about those games, is that they dealt with, you're not Luke Skywalker.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even see Luke Skywalker or, you know, Leia or Han Solo or any of these people, right? It's like there's something that happened somewhere else. Well, except for the Battle of Yavin kind of thing, but it's, I don't even remember. Was Luke even mentioned or any of that in the Battle of Yavin? Because you're the one that blows up the Death Star.
Right? I don't think so. We just sort of like, we're just not going to say anything.
Yeah.
We're not going to explain this.
Yeah,
you know, you're doing what Luke did, but.
Yeah. So, you know, make of it what you will. I like that. I like that you're not tied to the characters that way.
I think that's the best games tied into movies are the games that were made basically independently.
Mm-hmm.
As, you know, so many of the games that have come out, Hollywood basically commissions the game as part of their marketing effort. They don't understand games. They don't really care. And so, you know, they're under ridiculous schedules, and they expect the game developers to adhere to the ridiculous schedule as well. And so that was, you know, the huge blessing of doing those games when we did them was there wasn't any movie in the works.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the time to fully develop it, and, you know, it could stand on its own. When we were doing X-Wing Alliance, episode one was in the works. And one of the constraints that was imposed on us was our ship date. Was we had to have the game completed and out the door in the spring because the movie was going to be a summer release. And if we were not ready, they were going to sit on it until the fall because they thought that the audience would get confused if there was classic Star Wars and new Star Wars at the same time.
Right.
And
you know, and they've gone into a denial of classic Star Wars. Or did until Lucas Disney got him, right? There was just like this. I would say it was an aggressive denial. Like, we don't even want to talk about that. Yeah. That never happened. You know, it's like the new thing is the now, and, you know, merchandise this.
Yeah, well, that happened during the second movie. Was they realized that they were going to make a lot more money on the franchise licensing than the films, and it started turning into a toy commercial.
Well, you know, I remember with the first one, because I was 7 at the time, right? So, because I was born in 70. So I was the right age at the right moment to see this movie for maximum impact.
Yeah.
That it's just, you know, and everybody that's right around my age, it's like, and we didn't have you know, the VCR, right? So there was no watch this movie at home. You saw it in the theater. You saw it as many damn times as you humanly could in the theater. You know, I think, God, probably 12 times, because my parents dug it too, right? And it was just, I saw it in a drive-in movie theater the first time, and it just blew my mind. But Mom and Dad were right there with me, right? Like, my dad was a big Star Trek guy, so that was like his one great gift to me, was introducing me to Star Trek when I was really little.
My first memory of Star Trek was when it was originally broadcast, and I was like 6 years old.
Oh, wow.
And it was scary for a 6 year old. Because I remember a babysitter that I had watched it, and it bothered me. But then, like, I think it was a year or two later, that's all, I would run home from school. It's like, I gotta be home for Star Trek.
Yeah, it was, I don't know, just there was nothing before that was like it. It was like, I was watching Forbidden Planet the other night, and looking at that movie, and interesting that and Star Trek is the only times that we've ever had humans adopt a saucer shaped spacecraft, right? But it's yeah, looking at the way that thing was, and that wasn't so far before that. That was in the 60s too, right? I think.
Yeah.
Because Nielsen was in it, whole different vibe though.
Yeah.
Than the Star Trek thing.
There was two other series. They were English series that I really enjoyed at that time. Was Space 1999 and UFO.
Yeah, I love that. Yep, both of them. In fact, I have the full run of both shows. So yeah, I'm very, very familiar with Gerry Anderson,
and the spacecraft design in Space 1999 is actually really good.
I remember that my grandmother sent away because it was like box tops from Surreal or something, right? And it was like that and like $10, which was $1 million in the 70s. You could get the first wave of action figures, you know, where it was like Luke and Ben and R2-D2 and, you know, Darth Vader and stuff, right? And the X-Wing was the first ship that they had, and I had one of those. I got it for my birthday. But I remember Grandma actually mailed off to Kenner for these things with box tops from Aunt Jemima pancakes.
Wow.
Or some crap, right? and I got these things, and I'm like, wow, what the heck is this? And then there was a thing in Newsweek where they had an article about Star Wars. And it was like, yeah, this new movie, it's coming out, and it's, you know, all these cool robots and stuff. And I had a robot problem as a kid. Like, I was thoroughly addicted to robots. And, you know, so Grandma's like, look at this, man, they got robots in this movie. And I'm like, these robots are, like, dumb. That thing looks like a trash can. What the – no, that's – yeah. oh, how times have changed, right? But the thing was the merchandising deal around the toys, and I don't think that existed pre-Star Wars. There was like G.I. Joe dolls, but there was no action figures and vehicles and stuff. And that defined the frickin' 80s, man. That was like Star Wars, G.I. Joe, you know, everything was that. Transformers came out of it. Everything that was dear to my childhood, right? But in the Space 1999 thing, they made an Eagle that was to scale with the Star Wars figures. And I had it. I never had my buddy had a Millennium Falcon and he had an AT-AT walker. I didn't have any need for that because I had a 1999 Eagle and it was badass. So, and you too can have one for about $500 if you go on eBay.
Well, that you said the word scale. That is like one of my pet peeves with all of these big franchises, that they put out products that they don't even care whether it's in scale. And it drives me crazy.
Yeah.
I never really got into tabletop miniatures style war games because I didn't want to take the time to paint them all. But some years ago, Hasbro put out a line of Axis and Allies tabletop miniatures pre-painted.
Oh, that's neat.
And I thought, oh, great, cool. I can finally get into this. And their rules were simplistic, monkey spank, but the figures were cool. But then, you know, they started screwing up, and they had marketed it as an authentic, real, you know, these models are authentically rendered to be, you know, look like the real thing. But then they started screwing up, making mistakes, and things weren't in the right scale. At one point, they tried to pass off I think it was a German plane as a British plane. They just changed the paint on it.
Ooh, he gads. No.
Yeah, and their response to the righteous fury of their fans was to delete all those comments in the forums. And it was like, you really had no idea who your target audience was on this. You thought it was the you know, 10 to 14-year-old kids that are, you know, get obsessive about collecting all the toys, not realizing that actually probably more of your customers are 30 to 40 something and they've got disposable income and they're going to buy this shit by the case and you better get it right.
Yeah. So what was it for? Did they do like a tabletop war game out of it or was, okay.
Yeah. They had a hex grid map and a playing card with the data on the piece and, you know, each, they tried to do some sort of national characteristics and some special things for each different vehicle. The other weird thing was it was a collectible, right? So you go down, you spend $15 for your little booster pack, and it's going to have, you know, I don't know, 5 to 8 figures in it. There's going to be one tank and some infantry, machine guns, whatever. There was no rhyme or reason to what was rare.
Oh.
So, you know, you and I go down to the store and I open up my pack and I've got a King Tiger. That's awesome. And you've got this Romanian tank that nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah.
it's a piece of shit. I was like, what? And like the T-34-76, the single most mass produced tank in history, they made that a rare.
Wow. Probably, you know, I bet I understand, like thinking about it as a marketing guy is like, let's make the ones that people know rare, because that's the ones they're going to be after, because the familiarity.
No, because
right?
the Sherman and the Panzer IV were commons.
Oh.
So like I said, no rhyme or reason.
Hmm. Weird.
And I went a little crazy that summer. I started buying specific things on eBay.
Yeah, how long ago was this?
About 2006, I think.
Okay.
Because I don't know why I literally went a little crazy. I decided I had to have at least a platoon worth of tanks of all of them. Yeah, about $700 or $800 into it. My wife is like, we're going to put the brakes on this.
Yeah. Color me guilty. My guilty pleasure was Battletech.
Yeah. I totally understand that one.
Yeah. That was like a religion because we played it every Sunday. Rain or shine, and had the hobby shop with the terrain and all the But I had probably a ton of lead in my basement. It's like if I didn't get lead poisoning from that, I don't know why. But
well, Jack Mamias, the creative director on Starfighter Inc., he's a huge BattleTech fan.
Oh,
which
cool.
Was, you know, helped him out when he was doing the Mercenaries games. The Mech Warrior. Mm. Mech Warrior Mercenaries was one of the titles that he did.
Oh, was he in on the original ones, or was he like around Mech 4 and stuff?
I think he got involved on the second one and then was on, I think, most of the rest of them.
Oh, well, you're going to have to introduce us because there's the other show that we haven't publicly revealed yet is this is Space Game Junkie, and then we have Mecha Game Junkie. And it's currently in the kitchen being cooked right now. So
definitely hook you up because, yeah, he can tell stories. When we did our AMA on Reddit, unbelievable number of questions about Mech Warrior. When are you going to do another Mech Warrior? Hey, Jack, you did Mech Warrior, so when are you going to do another one? we're here to talk about Starfighter.
So the BattleTech thing and the miniatures and that leads me to ask about what you think about the Star Wars miniature game that just came out, because that too is, thank God they don't do sealed booster packs where, you know, you have to buy it and hope. But
I think it's overpriced.
Yes. Oh yes. $20 for a damn TIE fighter. Oh
yeah. Yeah. I managed to pick up a couple of copies on sale at Target. They were ridiculously, I don't know why they were clearancing them, but I'll buy three of them now. and I have yet to play it. I have so many games that I have not played. It's embarrassing.
Well, you lived here in Raleigh for a while, right?
So yeah.
Were you over in Forestville?
No. I remember. The apartment complex was on Shannon House Drive. I can remember that. And it was just up the hill from a shopping mall.
Okay, it's probably like North Hills or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so it's not like you were over in Cary and Apex and
nah,
that.
Nah.
So, okay. See, over toward Fayetteville, you know, where they got the military base, there's, of course, it's a military base, so there's all kinds of hobby shops and game stores and whatever, right? Because board service guys have to have something to do. And then here in Raleigh, we've had a couple of game stores that turned over, unfortunately. But there's one that's downtown now. And I went in there, and unfortunately, I went like on Magic the Gathering night. And Magic the Gathering is like, it's a blessing and a curse, because it was so profitable. Because I can crack open booster packs as the store, and I found a Black Lotus. I can sell this to somebody for $700,
mm-hmm.
right? And that was worth eating the price of like the four cartons of boosters that I had to open to get the damn thing. But then it was like the hobby stores that sold, you know, the role playing games and the tabletop miniature games and all that stuff became card shops. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very painful to that industry. So these guys are actually – they're coming back, right? So nobody's going to not have the card games because it's a cash cow. I'm shocked, actually. That game is still going strong. How many years?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It is truly amazing. I got into it for a little while. I actually still have my cards, so I don't think I've looked at them in 10 years. But, I mean, that – my lifespan has, you know, encompasses the entire birth and evolution of electronic games. And, you know, before that, like I mentioned, I got into the board war games.
Well, and it's like around the time that Gygax booted up D&D, right?
Exactly.
And very so early from 70s. So you've seen it end to end.
And the perspective of war gamers at the time, when RPGs took over, particularly D&D, is like, you know, we were kind of dismissive as, oh, Dungeons and Drag Queens, and it's, you know, typical, you know, late 20th century male idiots. And, you know, we just thought, oh, what a bunch of crap. I'm a wizard. But it came to utterly dominate and displace our favored style of gaming, and then in turn got displaced by the trading card games. And now it seems like everything's coming back. There's a market for everything.
Yeah. It's
truly a golden age of tabletop gaming. I frequent the Board Game Geek website. Mm. And some years ago, I was just curious, and it's a database, so it wasn't hard to do the research. And I decided to find how many war games are being published now, because you don't find them in many very many stores. And it turned out that there are more better war games being published every year now than back in the golden age of the 70s.
Oh, wow. So is the audience for this stuff heavily European still? Because that's where – that interesting parallel, right, between the space games and the role-playing games and tabletop miniatures and everything is like it broke out in America, and then it went to Europe to hibernate through the long winter of the American interest in it, right? And then it comes back, right? But it's like, well, the Germans had it for a while, and they, you know, they did the German thing, right? Like they tweaked it up, and now we have a mathematically exceptional system, and then we'll bring it back, kind of deal. But yeah, I've sort of seen that pattern, right? And then you see, like, with space games. It died here. I think it was like right after Free Space 2. For some reason, somebody right flipped the switch and it was over. Yep. And it was sad because Free Space 2 was, if not the best game. Yeah, it's still got legs today.
I think it was the perfect compromise between Wing Commander and X-Wing.
Yep, absolutely. Because the flight model was a little bit X-Wing and the story stuff. I agree with you. But the thing was, somebody flipped the switch. Nobody sold joysticks anymore, and it was just gone. I don't know if that's because, like, the first-person shooter and the RTS games had taken over, and the publishers said, that's the sure money. Don't make these expensive-to-make games that have a small audience. Make this mass appeal stuff. But all that stuff went to Europe to live then. Because the only way we could get a space game was this obscure, like, Eastern European stuff that was coming out of Croatia and whatever, right? And it's like...
Yeah. Well, yeah, because their cost of development is so much lower. And an American publicly traded corporation has no choice. They have to maximize shareholder return, and you don't do that by taking on the riskiest possible project.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's... But I guess, like, crowdfunding, right, has re-enabled it, would you say?
Absolutely, yeah. Between digital distribution and crowdfunding, it has completely changed the dynamic. Mm. And it's wonderful because you're seeing this explosion of creativity in the indie space. And, you know, that's a very loosely, you know, nobody agrees on what that really means anymore. But, you know, whether it's a lone, you know, bedroom coder, like we had in the 70s and the 80s, doing everything himself, but now he's putting it out on a mobile device, on up to AAA. There's something for everybody, and it no longer has the stigma that it had. You know, it's mm-hmm. a generational thing. When games first started to get popular in the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of people just thought it was a fad.
Right.
And most people who were adults at that time never got past looking at it as, these are toys, they're for children.
Well, it's like the nerd situation, right? Like all the abuse that we took in high school for being nerds. And now it's like, hey, we run this shit. You know, who runs the world? Yeah, the guy that you stuffed in the locker. So, you know. But... Yeah, it's sort of that shift, like the uncool thing has now become mainstream.
Well, so now the challenge is to just get noticed because there's so much out there.
I wanted to ask you about another thing with Star Wars too. The dreaded thing, okay, in Wing Commander, the worst thing is the jumping torpedoes. Right. Do you remember these missions where it's, I think they call it a skipper missile. So it's a torpedo that will destroy your capital ship if it hits, and it teleports because it goes normal speed and it charges its little warp engine, and then it warps, you know, a couple miles. And so you have to deal with
a stutter warp.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Those things are a bastard, man. And it was like, I gave Chris Roberts some shit about that. I was just like, dude, why? Why did you make my life hell with that? However, you And the space bombs. What the hell, dude, with the space bombs? Because there's some missions there where it's like TIE bombers coming out, and they're dropping those space bombs that drift forever, right? And it's like, I'm losing my ship. What's happening? Oh, God, they're dropping bombs. So there there is a lot of these missions that were kind of puzzly like that. It's like you play through the mission, and then you have to play it multiple times to actually realize what the heck's going on. And yeah. And it's like, why does this guy keep dying? You know, like, oh, well, at like 6 minutes in, there's going to be a Star Destroyer that jumps in, and it's going to kill that frigate there. So I have to make sure that I'm there when it jumps in to the whatever. So, I mean, it's kind of – was that a mindset when you guys were doing that? That it's like, okay, this is going to be an iterative thing. Like, they're going to have to play this mission 10 times to get it.
I don't think we consciously approached it like that. It was more, here's an encounter, here's the forces. Let's make this as interesting as we can. You know, if I was the opposing commander, how would I deploy my forces? And, you know, maybe I don't have complete freedom to do my perfect plan. I've got, you know, whatever weird constraints on my tactics. So this is how it's unfolding. And now we put the player in, and you're right, it's kind of a puzzle at first. It's like for a lot of missions, the likelihood that you're going to instantly grasp what's going on and do the right thing, probably not too high. And so you're going to die a few times before you realize, oh, that's what's going on. Okay, so now what should my tactics be? Okay, now I have to do – okay, I got it. I got to do this first, then that, then that, then that. And then it becomes a matter of execution. It's like, I know what I need to do. Can I get the timing right? Can I, you know.
And where that's most evidenced, to me at least, the missions that I have to do and do and do is the ones where you need pinpoint accuracy about I'm shooting down incoming proton torpedoes. And, you know, it's speed management and stuff, which XVT changed the game because now the throttle controls your turn radius. So
as I think that was always the case.
No, not.
Maximum turn rate was at 1/3 throttle.
No, it was XVT that changed that up because TIE Fighter didn't do that. You were continuous turn rate no matter how fast. I mean, you would have a tighter turn circle, but your actual degrees per second of deflection of the nose goes up as you cut the throttle back in XVT. Sorry, I played your game for 20 years.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I haven't played it in a long time, but I seem to remember it because I constantly would, when I got into a turning fight, I would be hitting the 1/3 throttle setting. Mm-hmm. That's why we had 0, 1/3, 2/3 full. But I defer to your recent experience playing the game.
Okay, but on the odds that I'm just hallucinating, all right, I'll call it even. Like, okay. It's indeterminate. But the thing is, you have to manage speed and your energy balance. There really wasn't a game that did energy balance stuff until X-Wing either. The lasers, shields, engines deal, and of course that's a standard in everything. I just bought Starhammer Tactics yesterday, and engines, lasers, shields. So, you know, it's right there. Which is, by the way, I know you like miniature stuff and whatnot. That's not a bad game. It's Harpoon in space, kind of.
Okay.
Yeah, it's turn-based, and what you do is you actually it shows, okay, your ship is here, and then it has an arc out in front of the ship, and you can drag the projected end position of your ship to anywhere in that arc, and then it'll draw a line like this is the path that this ship is going to follow, and then you click go, and it gives you 10 seconds of real time where the battlefield moves, and then it pauses again.
I like games like that.
I love that system. I would love a BattleTech game that did that.
Ed Killam, who was Larry's partner, those are the two names on the box for X-Wing and TIE Fighter.
Mm-hmm.
His previous game was RoboSport.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
I love that game. I encouraged him heavily to redo it.
Yeah, although RoboSport was kind of the XCOM of its era. Because, you know, it was like plot the moves of your guys and then watch them. Yeah. which those games are making a resurgence. I don't think XCOM ever really went away. It was just people made poor imitations. And then
that's one of my all-time favorites. Actually, earlier when you were talking about the game that you were helping out on, one of the things that came to my mind, one of my all-time favorite games is Battlezone, the one that came out in the late 90s.
Oh, yeah, on the moon. Russians.
Yeah, it was an RTS crossed with a vehicle simulator. And, you know, for me, that was a brilliant idea. I love the game. I love both of the genres, and I couldn't understand why it wasn't more successful, because it was very well executed. The reviews were very good. It just didn't sell big numbers.
Yeah. You know, the Battlezone 2, they're still actively modding.
Well, even Battlezone 2, they tried again. They streamlined the interface, and it still didn't take off, and so then they gave up. But that's my object lesson, poster child version when I'm explaining to students about when you cross genres, when you do a hybrid game, you're not getting both audiences. You're getting the cross section.
Yeah,
the
you get
overlap.
The Venn diagram.
Yeah. Stuff like that, you really have to research your target audience and verify that it exists. I mean, because the nice thing about being an indie today with the low barrier of entry is that you can pursue your dream, and whatever your idea is, you can probably make it. But are you going to be able to sell it?
Yeah.
Because the frustration that I often felt with a lot of publisher marketing teams was that they wanted it to be a marketing-driven process. It's like, okay, well, this is what's hot right now. This is the feature set that people are looking for. So we've got this franchise. This is the hot genre. This is the feature set. Go make that. And because they already know how to sell it. But when you come to them with something that's somehow innovative, new, different, off their radar, they just would look at you like, oh, we don't know how to sell this.
Right, because the key – somebody had mentioned this months ago to me. They said the way to do it is, if you can elevator pitch somebody, it's like this, but with that.
Yeah.
Right? It's the established thing with this twist. It's Railroad Tycoon in space.
And ideally, this was my opinion, the best marketing people are they understand marketing, they understand audiences. And so once you tell them what it is that you've got, they know how to find your audience and let the audience know, hey, This thing exists now that you guys are going to love.
Yeah, the Kickstarter deal. So you guys, how close did you get?
We are currently at 189,090 and 5,058 backers with 33 hours to go.
Oh, so how much money do you need?
$250.
$250?
Yeah.
I got that in my pocket right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
What, $250,000?
So yeah, we need another 60,000.
Oh, okay.
Which we're told is entirely doable.
Yeah, I've seen it happen. I've seen it like close up, right at the end, like stuff. And an interesting thing happened with some other guys that we had on, where they were doing a game and they had, like, at the last minute, somebody came in and funded them like the remaining $2,500 or whatever, right? But then it turned out like a hoax, like they backed out. But
yeah, that same person got us over the 50% mark, and we were all thrilled and celebrating. Oh, somebody just gave us 10 grand. All right. And then pulled it. And the guys that team that it pushed them to success, and then minutes before it ended, they pulled it and caused it to fail. They actually contacted us to warn us. Yeah, this guy. This is the name.
Oh, good. Yeah, because I told them. I was like, man, that's – horrific. But while the buzz, like while the news is covering your tragedy, spin up that Indiegogo right now, because we can divert those eyes over. But they lucked out though, because Kickstarter came back and said, okay, we're going to let you keep the money and we're going to start the clock back at 30 days. So, and I'm sure they've made it by now.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah. So we had them on like a month ago, and it's super great guys to talk to, by the way. It's if you get a chance, jump on the phone with them and just chat, because they're super duper dudes. So anyway, yeah. So best of luck on that. And I will get this up as quick as I can while you guys still have, you said you got what, like 30 hours or something?
33 hours.
33 hours.
I think we're going to do a live stream for the last 6 hours.
Okay. Get up on Twitch and play the game or something, or
what? I don't know exactly what they have in mind, but I told them I would make myself available.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, let me know. I mean, you got my contact info, so just ping me if you guys are going to take it up live or something. I want to see it. Now, of course, if you wish to send me a copy, I will not refuse. So just let me know when it's time for that. But yeah, this has been great, and I feel like we're besties now. It took me 17 years to have this conversation. So it's
long overdue. Well, yeah. And hit me up, friend me on Facebook, and I'll invite you to the friends and family for the project.
We got awesome.
A secret little group.
Ooh. I'm in the family. This is awesome. It's like being in the mob. Yeah. No, different family. Okay.
It's blood in, blood out, man.
Oh, yeah.
You may want to.
All right, man. This has been great. And take your lady out. Show her a good time.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for spending so much time with me. We actually only covered a fraction, so we'll have to do this again.
Okay, excellent. So, all right. Thanks,
man. All right, man. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.